Well, as I mentioned to the folks at Knox, this is about the only time I've been tempted to set a timer to make sure I actually stop talking at some point. I realize that that's more of a threat than you know. I usually manage to rise above it. But the two things coming together this Sunday, this at least some recognition of the beginning of World War I 100 years ago tomorrow, and an Old Testament lesson come together for me in some very significant ways. But they're still sort of swirling around, and I've been thinking about this for a while, and I know where I'm going, so I just need to make sure I don't get caught up in some of the little byroads, interesting as they are to me, and maybe even to you, but still don't get us where we're going in the way that we need to. And I have been thinking about this for a while, because the Presbyterian Church of Canada sent along the request that we look at doing something in honor of tomorrow's centennial came some time ago, and so that's been on my mind ever since. The First World War is something I have a certain amount of knowledge about, obviously not firsthand, but still know some things about it through reading, through my own interests. At one point, I thought I'd become a historian, probably a military historian, in fact, so obviously I have some idea of what's going on there. But why on earth would we talk about that in church, other than to make mention of it? How can it have anything to do with what we might talk about in a sermon? Well, it does. So first of all, let's leap back to our Old Testament story, the story of Jacob. Yet another one of our opportunities to look at Jacob, to realize that there are many people in the Bible who are as fully human as we are, no matter how much we try to turn them into heroes. They're still people. Lots of interesting challenges, much to teach us, and the occasional example for us of what not to do. Well, Jacob at this point is on his way back to reunite, hopefully without being killed, with his brother. This is a family that has challenges, to say the very least. Jacob's parents both committed what some people would consider almost the cardinal sin of parenting, and that's telling which one of your children is the favorite. Assuming you're willing to admit even to yourself that you have a favorite, keep it there. You don't want to be telling your kids that they're the favorite. And Jacob's mother had always let him know that he was, in fact, her favorite, which I suppose was offset by the fact that Jacob's father favored Jacob's brother. So you just have this ongoing mess. Jacob's on his way back to meet with the brother who has, in the past, promised to kill him next time he sees him. So it's a bit of a challenge for him. He sends his family across the ford at Jabbok, and then he's left alone, and he wrestles with a man till daybreak. Wrestling is a peculiar form of fighting. There are some kind of fighting that you really only need one side to be interested in fighting. And that's just the way it is. If somebody wants to do it, they can, and if you don't defend yourself, well, you're still going to lose. Wrestling is different. If you want to think of it this way, some forms of fighting are more like a lecture, where the person up front can say whatever they want, and it doesn't matter what you do. And wrestling is more like a conversation, much like we have here. As I've said before, this is a conversation. I mean, I do the talking, but you're still engaged. You're still part of what we're doing when we're worshiping together. And wrestling is one of those things that both of you have to do it, or it's not really wrestling. In fact, in wrestling, and I'm talking about the real wrestling, not the ones where you jump off the ropes and is on television. I'm talking about the real thing that has rules that are actually followed. If you're in a wrestling match and you don't wrestle, you lose. The referee warns you once and then you've lost, because you both need to be engaged in the process. And so here Jacob is wrestling, and he is obviously engaged with this person. That at first it just appears that Jacob thinks it's just a man who came out of nowhere, so Jacob being Jacob probably leapt on him. We don't know who started it, but my money's on Jacob starting it, because he started everything else that we've ever read about. And so they wrestle till daybreak. The man then touches Jacob's hip, yanks it out of the socket, and then says, "Let me go." Jacob says, "No, you have to bless me." Jacob is somebody who has known from his earliest days that he is going to be blessed. Prophecy was made that Jacob would be blessed, that God's blessing on the entire world would come through Jacob. So this is not new to Jacob, this whole idea of blessing. What is peculiar throughout all of Jacob's life is his steadfast refusal to let God work in God's time. Jacob once again tries to grab something that's freely offered to him. Jacob seems to hurt himself fairly often. Not because he has to, but because he with such violence grabs something that is freely given to him that he hurts himself. It's like a little kid. Sometimes you see this in children. When you offer them something, a treat or a toy or something, they're in such a rush to get it, like you're going to take it away, that they fall over or they hurt their hands grabbing it so hard. And as a parent, you always think, "What? No, it's yours. You don't have to do that. Nobody's taking it away. It's not going to evaporate." Jacob never seemed to grow out of that. There's no sense anywhere in the story of Jacob that God's blessing is conditional on Jacob choking it out of God. It's coming no matter what. So Jacob, after all this wrestling, gets the blessing. But he also gets a limp. There's a strong implication in the text that this limp that Jacob has goes on more or less for the rest of his life. An ongoing reminder of this wrestling match that he had. So was Jacob blessed or was Jacob not blessed? Well, obviously he was blessed. Did Jacob have a limp or did he not have a limp? Obviously he had a limp. These two things go together. He ended up with a limp whether he wanted it or not. And we don't know if the limp was part of the blessing. It could be. But let's hold all that together and in our imaginations go back to the beginning of the last century. By this time, 100 years ago, war was absolutely inevitable. Everybody knew it. There was no chance of anybody turning back at this point. History or the movements in history had taken on a life of their own, and it was probably beyond the ability of the people involved to make it to halt it at that point. And it's impossible for us to overstate the importance of the First World War to world history. It changed everything. As I said before, whether we like it or not, it was a Eurocentric world before then. Yes, China was in isolation. There were parts of South America that nobody really knew anything about. But when it came down to it, in the global scheme of things, Europe was what made things happen. 4 years later, that was on its way out. Gone forever. The locus of power and influence had left Europe and gone somewhere else. It changed everything. Before that, there were absolute monarchies all over the place. After that, they began to disappear if they didn't disappear already. Before that, there was this ongoing sense that if you were the king, the Kaiser, the Tsar, the people existed for your needs, your desires. And that was it. They had no say in what their country did. And it's not that all countries were the same. There was good and bad. There was movement in various directions. And what brought the world first to the brink and then into this war itself is tremendously complicated. There's lots of blame to go around for every side who did foolish things. But it changed things because of what happened. It's tempting at this stage, this historical distance, to try and decide who was right and who was wrong. Who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. And it's tempting because it makes it easier for us. And there's undeniable morality involved. But at the same time, just like us, it's a mixture of good and bad. When things finally came to a head on August 4th, 1914, both sides looked at it as an opportunity for good to vanquish evil. But when we look at it from the perspective of history, we do see some things that came out of it that we are grateful for. As I said, prior to that conflagration, there were autocratic governments. Germany was one, Austria was one, Russia was one, where what the king said went. There was still a very strong sense of that in other countries in the world, but England was trying to figure out what it meant to let people vote. They were even considering the radical possibility that women might have something to say there also. Imagine that. France was going through its own challenges, trying to figure out how to function as a republic instead of as a failed monarchy. In a very real sense, what this war came down to was, are we going to live in a world in which a single person or a very, very small group of people can have the ultimate say over the lives of the people in a country, life or death? It wasn't really settled permanently after that, but still, when we look at the First World War, when we look at the unimaginable suffering and carnage that went through there, and I say unimaginable because it is, one of the things that strikes me is that every time I come back to reading about the First World War, I'm stunned again, as if I'm encountering it for the first time, the level of destruction that that conflict ended up inflicting on the world. Hundreds of thousands of children. We think of them as young men. I think of them as high school students. 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, getting ready to go to university, perhaps going to university. Think of yourself at 20 or at 18. Going off to fight for king and country, following your duty as you understood it best, on both sides of the conflict, to be chewed up in the tens of thousands, to move an arbitrary line 10 or 20 meters, over and over and over again. More than 800,000 British young men died. 800,000. Millions overall. This brought conflict in a completely new way, something that had never been seen before. Countries mobilizing against each other to an extent that was unimaginable, even by Napoleon, the first general who ever commanded a million men. Civilians involved to an extent that had never been seen before. Destruction everywhere. And yet, at the end of it, pointless as we can say it was, because it led to another war, which led to the Cold War, which led to where we are today with conflict in all kinds of other places. Pointless as we're tempted to consider it. Let's consider the alternative. Obviously, we're not reverse prophets or whatever you call it when you look back in history and say, well, if that would have happened, this would have happened. But when we look at what the Axis powers, the Triple Alliance, whatever they called themselves back then, Germany, Austria, the culture, the society that they had was not one that most of us would be comfortable with. And when we look at the potential of what would have happened if they would have carried the day, I suspect Europe would not be a place that very many of us would wish to visit. Autocratic, top down to an extent that makes our current 1% issue look like egalitarianism run amok. So when we look at the conclusion of the war, even allowing for the foolishness that led directly into the next one and all the rest of it, I think we can look at it and say, overall, things were better off. But so what? How does that relate to us? Am I for a moment suggesting that the First World War was a blessing? No, I am not. I'm suggesting the First World War is a limp. I've never had the opportunity to interact at any depth with someone who served in the First World War. Some of my relatives did, and I'm sure some of yours did. Grandparents or great-grandparents, depending on where you are in the whole demographic thing, or some of that nature. Some of my uncles and great-uncles served. Some refused to. Didn't leave anyone untouched, one way or the other. And I haven't had that opportunity to speak to them face-to-face, but I've known a number of Second World War veterans, and talking to them enhances my understanding of the writings and the journals and diaries of First World War soldiers, and I think I understand some parts about them. Because one of the things we need to remember is that many of those who went to serve from Canada and Germany, from Austria and England and France and Belgium and all those other places were just like us. On Sundays, they were in a church just like this one. They believed in God just like we do. They loved Jesus with all their hearts just like we do. And yet they stepped into that breach. And when I talked to these men, at least one military nurse, but primarily the men are the ones that I've talked to who served in the Second World War, came out of it, changed, of course, but looked at it as a form of duty that they would never have chosen, but that they fulfilled because of this world in which we find ourselves. Who looked at the world as it actually is, rather than as we want it to be, fallen as it is, depressingly awful as it is, while simultaneously being wonderful in other ways, and said, "This is God's call upon me, that I can't really reconcile with a loving God as well as I would like, but this is my duty. I am going to go." I learned more about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, to be someone who functions in and loves the church from those men than maybe anyone else. They understood the cost of the fallen world in which we live in a way that I don't. Would they have chosen that? No. Were they willing to take the insights about themselves and about God and about the world? Were they willing to give those up? No. Wounded healers tend to be the best healers. If I'm going to see a doctor, I want to see a doctor who has actually had something go wrong with them at least once. A dentist who's never had a cavity tends not to be quite as compassionate about your own struggles as another one who has. People who have gone through this kind of struggle understand all struggle better because of it. If they're willing to learn, if they're willing to go through it as the people they are and allow this horrifying circumstance they never would have chosen to shape them in ways that God can make for the good of all. Would Jacob have given up his blessing to lose the limp? I don't know, but I don't think he would have. If Jacob would have been told that because of the choices he made, he was going to get a limp, but the blessing came with it, would he have continued on? I think he would have. There's something about us that, as I've said before, wants that either or. We want to create a dichotomy. We want to say that the First World War was a time of glorious struggle for right over wrong, or is a complete disaster with no redeeming qualities or benefits or effects at all. And that's just too simplistic. For us to look at Jacob as a wretched person, a manipulator who struggled with everything, and God blessed for who knows why, we lose sight of Jacob's essential humanity. If we look at Jacob as saying that his actions were irrelevant to God's blessing, we lose sight of a God who treats us as we need to be treated, as a God who is willing to do whatever it takes to turn us into the people he wants us to be, the people we were created to be, even sometimes giving us a limp. Could God have blessed Jacob without that? Of course he could have. Would Jacob have become the patriarch he was without it? I doubt it. We can look at the First World War from the perspective of it being nothing but a waste of time. And I have tremendous sympathy for that. Or we can look at it as another opportunity to understand that sometimes a fallen world means we're blessed in the midst of it. Sometimes even in spite of fallenness. Could God have worked out the good things that came out of the First World War in individual lives and in the geopolitical world without it? Of course he could have. Could he have done so without running roughshod over the choice that he has given us all as volitional human beings? I don't think so. As I've said before, as I've said many times, I often wonder why God trusts me with choice, let alone all of us. I just think, wouldn't it be easier if I had no choice? If I couldn't sin? And yet, would I still be human? No. We remember those who served in the First World War. We remember the outcomes of that and all conflict. Not from a sense of glory, not from a sense of despair. We remember it because of the duty that those who were in it felt they were fulfilling, believing strongly, if erroneously, that what they were doing was right. We're not here to judge. We're here to remember. In a moment, we're going to have that moment of silent reflection, and it's entirely up to you what you think of. It won't be very long. It won't be the 2 minutes by clock that we do on November 11th. It'll be a moment or two. And if you're not sure what to reflect on, I encourage you to reflect on this. That God's deep, deep love for us as full-range human beings is so profound that he allows us to do things that are destructive to ourselves and even to others. But his love doesn't end there. If you would have asked anyone in 1917 if there was any God anywhere who had some part in that conflict, no one would say so. But where we are now is a place we wouldn't be without that. And so many of the good things that we enjoy here in Canada as Canadians would never have happened without that war. Canada came of age. The independence, the creativity, all that makes this such a wonderful place to live would not be here without that. Is that blessing real? Absolutely. Did it come at a cost? An unbelievable and unimaginable cost. It came with a limp that's with us still, in lives destroyed, an earth that you can still see the traces of that conflict of even now in aerial photographs of that part of France and Belgium. The limp is there. We can never forget the limp. But let's take some time to remember the blessing as well.